You're listening to Community Radio.
KBOO, Portland.
This is your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kbu.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kbu.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thank you.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than here in the time of COVID. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. I do have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read a couple of poems by Elizabeth Alexander, who should need no introduction to most of my readers or most of my listeners. Elizabeth Alexander was born in Harlem, New York, but grew up in Washington, D.C. She's a pivotal figure in African American poetry, a founding member of Cave Canem, president of the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. She served as the inaugural Frederick Iseman Professor of Poetry at Yale University and formerly chaired the African American Studies Department, also at Yale. And her book, American Sublime, was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize. In 2005, she was awarded the Jackson Poetry Prize. And many people will remember her as the inaugural poet at President Obama's first inauguration. So I'm going to read two poems by Elizabeth Alexander. The first one is titled Crash. I am the last woman off of the plane that has crashed in a cornfield near Philly, picking through hot metal for my rucksack and diaper bag. No black box, no fuselage, just sister girl pilot wiping soot from her eyes, happy to be alive. Her dreadlocks will hold the smoke for weeks. All the white passengers bailed out before impact, so certain a sister couldn't navigate the crash. Oh gender, oh race, oh ye of little faith, here we are in the cornfield, bruised and dirty but alive. I invite sister girl pilot home for dinner at my parents', for my mother's roast chicken with gravy and rice, to celebrate. That was Crash by Elizabeth Alexander, and this poem is titled Butter. My mother loves butter more than I do, more than anyone. She pulls chunks off the stick and eats it plain, explaining cream spun around into butter. Growing up, we ate turkey cutlets sauteed in lemon and butter, butter and cheese on green noodles, butter melting in small pools in the hearts of Yorkshire puddings. Butter better than gravy staining white rice yellow. Butter glazing corn in slipping squares. Butter the lava in white volcanoes of hominy grits. Butter softening in a white bowl to be creamed with white sugar. Butter disappearing into whipped potatoes with pineapple. Butter melted and curly to pour over pancakes. Butter licked off the plate with warm alaga syrup. When I picture the good old days, I am grinning greasy with my brother, having watched the tiger chase his tail and turn to butter. We are Mumbo and Jumbo's children, despite historical revision, despite our parents' efforts, glowing from the inside out, 100 megawatts of butter. That was Butter by Elizabeth Alexander. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Arab American poet Claudia F. Salibi Savage, whose work appears in print, on stage, and in museums. She explores multidisciplinary collaboration and diaspora. She is part of the performance duo Thicken the Throat Honey, and is currently working on a jazz-influenced text and performance about the U.S. response to the Syrian refugee crisis. Her collaboration Reductions, about motherhood and ephemerality, with visual artist Jacqueline Brookman is forthcoming in Detroit in 2023. She has awards from Gentel, UCross, the Atlantic Center for the Arts, Oregon Arts Commission, and Portland's Regional Arts and Culture Council. She's been a Black Earth Institute Fellow and a former writer in schools in Oregon, North Carolina, and Colorado. Her poetics are influenced by rabid reading, Alice Coltrane, and long hikes in drippy forests. Apparently, that's why she moved to the Pacific Northwest. She teaches, works in the field of renewable energy, and lives with her husband and daughter in Portland, Oregon, and you can visit her at www.claudiafsavage.com. Welcome, Claudia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Would you like to read some poetry?
I would love to. I'm going to read from a couple different things, but I thought I'd start out with a number of poems about family, because I like to sort of read pieces from where I am in that moment. That sort of makes me deeply happy, rather than trying to align myself with maybe a particular text I'm working on at the moment. And so this particular poem, the first poem I'm going to read, is about me. It's a very tiny little poem. And then I'm going to read a couple of poems about my family. So this is called Why I Groove. Why I groove. Because when I hip curl, dream swirl enough, the mirror remembers the beautiful skin I'm in for the long haul. Wrinkles and sunspots and all, I pound the floor with my too narrow heel. My shaking bones flood my blood, and I am base, and I am dare, and I am sweat ignited hair. Dance is the free me you might not see. See? I'm going to read two poems about my daughter, which are more in relation to, one is about the earth. I really love this poem. I've been sort of sending it around. But this is when my daughter was quite young. She's 9 now. This is when she was 4. This is called Cure. There is no hurry, but I hurry. Pump the day through my exhausted heart. Want to be done and want to linger all at once. I inhale the evening jasmine, touch the flowering lavender, stop for rain-crushed after rain-crushed rose, till you could crush me too, rub me for scent. There is always time until there isn't, and you wonder why you didn't get out of your chair, out the door, why you didn't approach the night in its damp forgiveness. The clouds would have welcomed one more crimson cheek, one more breathy climb toward the unreachable. My 4-year-old daughter says, "Is the snow coming in or out?" Pointing to a picture in her favorite book with frozen ponds where rabbits skate. "Like the tide?" I ask. Last month, she cowered before the Pacific's immensity, ran away to make sandcastles close to the wind-sculpted hemlocks, far from the water's reach. I tell her all things come back to the earth. Shells break and crumble, seaweed marries driftwood. When we dance bare feet to wet sand, our heels throb from jumping. I climb the hills above my house alone, so she may rest and sort the mystery. My husband soaps 1,000 dishes, so I may remember the sky. It doesn't care that I am below it. but the ground, I believe, likes to be walked, likes to be soaked by water, petals. I turn around and there is a rainbow, my first in 10 years, over the place I've left, where my daughter dreams the snow's heartbeat, oceanic multitudes, raspberry rings, roses revolving, shells eroding, green on green on green, where she imagines herself a cloud above the sea, above my weary heart, she and I expanding together, absorbing this night, everything. I wrote that one much before the pandemic, but it feels appropriate when so many of us were sort of the only kind of relief we could get from whatever walls we were in was to go outside. And I thought I'd read this one as well. I realized the other day when I was up in the Olympics in Washington State with my family, how much my daughter depends on being outside and how I was considered such a strange child growing up in New York City because I really love the outdoors. I joined the Girl Scouts when I was a kid and specifically to backpack. And my mother was like, I don't know whose child you are. Like, who are you? My parents were such urban people. Like, they were like, who dropped you here? Like, you're not our kid. Like, I didn't mind getting, you know, poison ivy, and I got bitten by a snake once. I mean, I just didn't care. And so I find it quite beautiful that my daughter is, this is so normal to her. It's not anathema to her life the way it was for mine. So this is the only piece that I wrote during the beginning of the pandemic. I was pretty paralyzed by what was going on. But this is called Vulnerable. This is for my daughter. Hail pelted the lettuce again, and my 7-year-old did magic. Twirling stick, pink petals, damp air, over the limp leaves. Her belief in healing matches that of the earth we let wild in the back. Perennial garlic, purple dead nettle, dandelion thick as saplings. I could give up my daughter's wishes, ignore her friends down the street who go hungry with the schools closed. Everything still might crush us. We kneel the damp earth to peel each torn leaf from its heart, walk the yard with our battered salad. Tomorrow we'll make extra bread for the mother-in-law, place groceries on the neighbor's porch, call someone alone or afraid. We don't intend to wait until we're strong. This next piece I'm going to read as I'm going through my family, this is about my brother. I have a larger book. So the book that is sent out in the world right now is the book about Syria that Teal mentioned, and jazz improvisation. And this particular piece is from another book. I have 3 books that are in sort of finishing stages. This particular piece is about my brother. He died of ALS the year my daughter was born. We were very close, and this piece is one, my brother is probably, actually it's funny that I chose this one to go after the other one while I was just talking about the natural world. My brother was a climber and a geologist, and he, like me, sort of escaped New York City. But he was the kid who was, like, you know, always climbing the lamppost, you know, with his bare hands. It's pretty awesome, where he grew up in Harlem. So this is for my brother. It's called If You Must Choose Wings. My brother, crows murder the sky this clear morning, and an owl awakens long before night. Your niece points to its startled low song, which comes round as we round the trail again, it too circling, gathering its wide head, then spitting the morning our way, as she holds her first buttercup, a siren of yellow under pine and fir. The sun rushes us to shade, another light on summer's beauty. My brother, where is the rot of September? the rot of oak leaves shaken from their stems, the final dandelions bursting. My brother, make the crows cry louder, louder, my brother. The displaced owl flies terror to the mole. Water steals earth from earth. My brother, where is that rain? Where is that sign, that mirror in wings announcing your birthday, my daughter's, the same date? My brother, let us blame the moon's cruel joke on the owl, bringing my daughter here just as you left. Your bones, my brother, were hollow as a bird's, your black hair lush as an oiled feather, muscled legs narrowed to thread. You might have joined this murder, staking your place in the pine. Take these wings and loudly spin, my brother. If you must leave my arms, confuse the night. Quick, my brother, quick. Hide here in the sky. Yeah, I have a firm belief that the poems kind of tell you where they want to be when you're thinking about doing any kind of reading, or even when you're putting a book together. They just tell you. I know there's some people who do things chronologically. My books are much more complicated than that, usually. And I could keep rearranging them forever. So this morning when I was sort of thinking about what to read, I was thinking about that and how, because we're recording this early, everyone in the pandemic, we're recording this early. So this next piece is a piece about my dad. My father has suffered from pretty severe depression most of his life. It's a source of pretty intense shame for him, and I didn't write about it for a very, very long time. But this particular piece, my dad's at the end of his life right now. He's been quite ill, and so I don't know what it is, but there's something about the way in which mental illness has started to be talked about in our country that gives me it just gives me great succor. Like it's helped me sort of come to grips with sort of some of the shame I felt as a child, because my dad wasn't very participatory, and there wasn't a lot of language around how I could talk about that. So this is called Awaken for my dad. My father asks for happy poems. He pleads, write me as you remember. But he doesn't know what I remember. Darkness as jailer. My father's exile. In the bedroom for days. Lights off. Shades down. My brother's army men outside the door. Reconnaissance for the sun. Blame the dark. Darkness can upend you. It is not my story. My father at 3, locked in a closet. Voice swallowed. Sight stolen. Darkness as hunger. Stop me before I remember. The caves in California. Father behind me, mother beside. The guide blew out his lantern. Quick, darkness, quick. Above the other children snickering, a wailing. The rock, my father, as conduit. We did not run. Reached toward the unknown animal. I want to avenge him. I remember Rockefeller Center on my father's shoulders, the crowd, cacophonous bees reaping Christmas honey, animals roasting the spit of Fifth Avenue, chestnuts popping their outer coverings, that massive tree, Atlas, bearing the world's troubles, ice skaters swirling the air to ribbons, a switch, a sigh, together, father, look, the light. I thought, now I'm going to kind of get into the pieces that are in my most recent book that's out there. It's making the rounds. It's really funny, everyone, because right now people keep asking me when my book is coming out, and they're like asking me to join them for readings in the next 6 months as if it's happening. I think that's great. I like that optimism. Perhaps I keep getting semi-finalist. I don't know. Maybe in a year I'll get finalist, and then in another year it'll get published. I'm laughing. So this is a series. There's a series of pieces about my grandmother. It's actually my dad's mom. So all these seem to be interlocking in some way. My Siddhi, she was a really special woman, my grandmother. I'm just going to read a couple pieces about her. I did sort of a hodgepodge in my book, just thinking about her and what she would think about the refugee crisis, the biggest one, bigger than World War II. It's a good one. It's a good thing to remember, everyone. Like, this pandemic is happening, and there are people all over the world who are suffering so greatly, and it's hard to focus on them because we ourselves are suffering. We have so much loss happening here, right? So, but it's good to remember that that is going on. So this is called Siddhi Learns Her Address. Don't cross the phantom line from Washington Street to where the Italians and Jews have staked out their blocks. Garlic hung in double helix, planets of cheese, kitchens tight as a fist. Before this, did I even exist, or was I just deep green mountain breath and blown cloud? The daughter of priests. Not Lebanon, but something before the French. Something where Muslims and Christians nodded to neighbors under the shadow of Mount Sinai, Ottoman, Greek, Melkite, Maronite, Muslim, something, the M in the mouth watering like a salted lemon, Zakhle, city of poets and wine. Here, buildings blaze and tremble with the Levant, Little Syria, Arab ghetto, slum. One brother fights the Irish boy, 50 pounds larger, to defend the smallest brother. His nose breaks. The other boy's nose breaks. Always a border somewhere, and those intent on crossing. The streets heave iron. This place wants to send them back. She misses sand. She misses foam. I will say that those last two lines are Khalil Gibran, who my grandmother had sort of a funny relationship with. She did not like him. My grandmother was a very conservative woman. She thought Khalil Gibran's life, look it up, everyone who's listening. He was a scamp, all right? He was like, he had like 20 women like doing things for him. It was really funny. All right, so that's an aside. But those are his two lines. So lovely. This is Siddhi Learns the Word Cat. In the back of the classroom on a stool, in the back of the classroom, she stares at the letters straight as desks, straight as the hair of the child in front of her, straight as the floor, the ceiling, no dance in them, no wind, no dome for bread or prayer to achieve its shape outside the trees surrender leaves to hidden sun. She wonders how an animal so full of vibration, its tail another music, could be held in such harsh lines. The tea a rude spitting, no sweetness on the tongue. I still can't decipher my grandmother's recipes. I just thought I'd share that. The Arabic is very fast. Who knows? This is... Siddhi knits hats after dinner for people living on the streets. My grandmother had grown up very, very poor, and she was always very concerned about people who did not have any kind of home. And I've been thinking about that a lot with what's going on in Portland. And just the level of houselessness is so intense right now. And yeah, I've been thinking a lot about what my sweet grandmother would say about that, how she was always going out and bringing sandwiches and knitting hats and blankets. So this is for her. In front of the TV, early 1980s. Why are you crying? Buildings pockmarked and smoking. Women veiled, unveiled, wailing, hands up. Blood, black, splatter. Their pale sweaters, heart shatter. That was for the Lebanese Civil War, that one. Which was very, very painful for my grandmother. And this next poem I'm going to read about her is one which a journal, the About Place journal, just nominated me for a pushcart. Oh, you know how it is, Teal. I'm going to tell Teal. You know, a million nominations. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride. But we'll see. All right, this is... This is Siti, teaches me Arabic as pastry. Arabs invented mathematics, so you triangle the dough so quickly I dizzy. I thought everyone ate them. Sweet, fatty lamb and rich pine nuts, cinnamon and bitter parsley, yogurt tang to sweat the tongue. Your recipes, undecipherable dashes and ribbons across the paper, a dance in the mouth even before the mouth. Silent, confident fingers that crease and twirl. It can't be 30 years, Siti. How could you go before teaching me the word for faith, for hope? February 2021. 12.4 million Syrians are food insecure. 80% of the displaced are women and children. Where is your recipe? Numbers I can understand. 1 tablespoon of cinnamon, 4 cups of milk. Sorrow steals my sleep. I am not immune. I need handfuls of surety, pastry commune, green parsley bruise, the only ache. And I thought, now I do a couple of other poems from my book. We're gonna get more heavy, everybody. This was, I had to, but it was very difficult for me when I was thinking about what to write for this book. There's gonna be a poem that I'm gonna read, which is sort of the probably the impetus for me writing about Syria. And I will do a quick plug. There's a piece that just came out in Poetry Northwest called Repair that I wrote about my decision to write about the Syrian refugee crisis. As an American, I think right now in this moment, we feel often as artists that we need a justification for our empathy sometimes, I think, in a certain way, like who we align with and why. And I think part of the beauty of being an artist is that you can just keep opening your heart wider. You can just get bigger, you know? Everyone can fit in there, all that pain. So all those people who need you to see them. So for me, because I had an infant when the Arab Spring began, I was watching everything that was happening while I was nursing and, you know, talking to friends and everything, activist friends in different parts of the Arab world, and feeling very hopeful at first and then utterly devastated. And I didn't quite know how to engage it because obviously I'm not living in Syria. But I wanted to engage it as somebody who comes from a family of immigrants. And so I started to engage it from the perspective of looking at other families there and their suffering and thinking about what would be happening for me with my suffering if I had my infant and I was dealing with what they were dealing with. So these next few poems are about that. This is called In My Arms, You'll Feather. You could be my child. I could hold you on my lap as another daughter, painting circles on the velvet warmth of your back. Small bone blades might sprout wings. In this brief nest, rest till your blood, Lebnis, thick, tangy salt. Sun sprays light through the window. Dust motes diamond your eyelashes. Let me look at you. Stroke your neck. Help you release your throat of lament. Imagine the wind as kind. Yeah. And so this next poem, I want to explain the Arabic, which I will probably butcher, but I'm going to try my best. There's so many dialects, and I get crap all the time from my Egyptian friends who say I don't know what I'm doing, but that's okay. I'm trying my best. I do my best. This poem is called Ya'abrni, and it means essentially you bury me, is what it translates to. It's kind of this idea that you love someone so much that you hope to die before them, which sounds really morbid, but it's sort of the thing of, like, you know, you love someone so much you don't want to live without them, like you don't want to be on this planet without them. And then there's also the phrase Kelyum, which means every day. So I'll just explain those two. I'll try not to do too much Arabic explaining, but this one feels appropriate. Other children ride their bikes over building bones. In pigtails, in torn sweaters, sun brights their eyes still. Through Iran, Turkey, Russia, we shake their fate like rubble. At some point, the numbers 400,000, 1 million, 1.2 million, scramble our brains numb. I rattle my ribs with fists, jolt this body, stare at one six-year-old's effort to make bike wheels turn, hold her face in my mind. The picture was taken yesterday, same day my daughter discovered the bell on her bike. It's ringing less warning than announcement. Joy. I bow my head, cover it, deference to all the ancestors. I whisper, God, Allah, Yahweh, please, anyone, save them. How should I pray? I forget. I'm a mother. Kalyum. I won't stop trying. So this one, this next piece is, so my family is from this area of Lebanon that's sort of, it's been Syria, it's been Lebanon, we have Syria, you know, it's what I'm doing, I'm moving my hands, you know, Till can see me moving my hands as we're recording this, but it is this thing of, like, those borders. I've been reading all these books about those borders because I'm sort of obsessed. Not just the, also because, like, there's so many stories in my family of, you know, my grandfather, you know, he loved the British but hated the French. It's sort of like everyone had to pick these sides, and why is this colonial better than that colonial, and this whole idea. And, you know, again, in these regions, you know, it's kind of like there's periods of peace, everyone's getting along, and then suddenly, oh, the Christians hate the Muslims, everyone hates the Jews, blah, blah, blah. And you get into this space, I think, and as an American, where you go, oh, that doesn't make any sense to me, I don't want to deal with it, you know, whatever. But these are the sorts of, to me anyway, these are the sorts of issues which these tribal issues are part of every family on the planet. And so I've been thinking about this a lot, about the arguments that happened at my dinner table as a child and how they felt so normal to me. And then I'd go across the street, you know, and there'd be the family that was Dominican, and they'd be having different arguments about different people. And again, so this particular piece is called Ballad for the Bird Children of Beka. And Beka is an area east of Beirut. It has been predominantly Christian, but there have been periods of time where, you know, a lot of Muslim Syrian laborers have come over and worked. It's a very fertile area. And so I've been reading a lot about that and thinking about my own family and thinking about cousins and just, yeah, it's been really fascinating. And so now there's there's huge refugee camps there. And I know that the Lebanese government is trying desperately to get people to just go back to Syria, as they are in Jordan and other countries. It just feels like an important thing to say for awareness. And so this is about a particular area in Beykaz where a variety of friends of mine were working and doing work before they weren't allowed to continue to go back there during the Trump era. They were stopped a lot when they came back into the United States and weren't allowed to go do their activist work there. So this is Ballad for the Bird Children of Beykaz. Tents sag to mud and wind, and children find ways to morning praise together. Stick, rock, feather. They squat the earth intent on a beetle's journey. Head turn at wind through an empty can. The call of a bird they do not know. City, they skip through star glow. Legs bone thin. They sleep deep despite the din. Nest comma curled in one bed. Brother, sister, mother. Head, head, head. Sing prayers to the new. Memorize the maze to the toilet pit. They listen to strangers. Their haphazard flock an excuse to spit and scream. Anything to forget their hollowed bellies. Wing beats that dream a fast escape to strange lands. The stars wink wrong in the sky. What was home becomes unknown. And I think I'll do one more from this this particular book. And I'm looking at my time real quick here, Teal. I think I'm doing okay. This one is Slip of Light is a piece that for some weird reason I have not gotten published. It's gotten me into various residencies and done various things, but I have not sent it out. And I think part of the reason is it feels very much like a piece that wants to live as a spoken piece and maybe not live on the page as much. So I'm not sure. I, like many, I was already sort of preoccupied with what was happening with the Arab Spring and Syria and various other countries. But many people in the world sort of had an awareness of what was happening in Syria based on the beautiful little three-year-old Alan Kurdi when he washed up on the beach. One of the things is trying to escape Syria to get to Greece. And the thing I think that struck me the most, not so much that this poor little boy had died, but that his father had survived and he had lost his wife and both his children. So this piece is called, and this is a difficult piece to hear, and so I will just say that. But again, I'm approaching all these refugee stories, I think, from the perspective of a parent. And so this piece is called Slip of Light. It's for Abdullah, the father who lost his family. For a moment before you hit the water, before you hit the water, before your father reached for the water, before the water, you checked your pocket for your stuffed bird, its turquoise wings safe and warm inside your coat. Before you and your pocketed bird flew through a low cloud, before you hit the water, you and your pocketed bird flew. Your father, your mother, your brother took flight near you. You didn't know your father scooped water before you hit. He scooped water, held the larger liquid, the dark black water, the body liquid, thinking it was you. Did he whisper shh, shh in your ear before you hit the water? His breath, the shape of waves, the sky, the clouds, the mist, melting water between your fingers, water on water, water to water, which way to water, with you in his arms, your mother beside, your brother in front near. Did it seem before, at first, for a moment, an adventure? Real and imagined, merging as water, as mist, as cloud, the land behind you lit and red, your heart the same burn. And your brother, only 2 years older, in on the lie. The story that your house would stay, the door a cradling mouth, your bed a blanket of pale yellow, embroidered suns saving your body's small sigh. Quick, quick, the sea will take us to Greece. Your father's hands a boat for your stuffed bird, up and down, till you smiled. Your mother's face another sea, wet with salt. Look, she pointed to the water. She fussed soft bangs from your eye. Your father's arms crushed your ribs. You in the boat, then your brother, then your mother. Tiny boat. Too many. 2 dozen in the boat before your mother's chest heaving, your brother gripping the hull, each knuckle a small white moon. The dark, confusing. Sea for sky. Waves thicken your ears, waves together. Water, wind, and wind, and wind, your father unsure. Hold the boat? Swim? Where was your brother? Where your mother? Where are you? The sea is greedy. Belly fat on whale and jellyfish. Porpoise, sardine, garbage continent drift, kelp cities, still it belches ships, dolphin, bone, coral, marooned bear. How to explain the smallness of a 3-year-old's lungs, an apple split, a ripe fig after the wasps retreat, the air's defeat to the push of water. And then the brother, and then the mother. How to explain a father forced to shore in the dark, alone. Arms so heavy, he doesn't know how, just before the waves, just before the water. Just before the water, he sang to the waves, he sang to everything, just before everything. Everything to the waves, the water, everything. The water in his hands, through his hands. Water. Empty of light. It's pretty hard to read something after that piece.
I can understand that. That was extremely powerful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Teal.
You know, I'd actually like to go back to something that you said about, you know, the decision to write and trying to find a way into it, which I think is really important because, you know, over the last, since like the middle of 2016, I think many poets have grappled with, you know, all this horrible stuff going on, beginning with the presidential campaign season that eventually Donald Trump became president, and the rhetoric that was going on during that campaign and then throughout his presidency and on into the present. And many poets that I knew were grappling with, I need to do something about this. And as a poet, of course, your immediate impulse is, I need to write about it. But how? You know, I think many poets don't want to write polemics, want to write good poetry, but yet poetry that serves the needs of the moment. And the danger always with witness poetry is that it can become appropriative. And I think that you navigate that really well by using the perspective of the parent, the perspective of a family, and that's kind of been your way into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could talk about, are there other ways into it for people who perhaps don't have that particular perspective, who aren't parents, and maybe don't also have the familial connection to a region?
Yeah, I really love that question, actually, Teal. I wish more people would ask me that question, because I think, you know, The biggest thing, and I tell my students this when I was teaching more, that it's not a popular way of being to be a poet, because to me, to fully be a poet is to allow yourself to have various rhythms. In other words, and I'm talking about emotional rhythms and the way in which you write. I find great value in, you feel overwhelmed by something and you just get something down, right? Right in that moment of passion. But I think what ends up happening is that the really good work, and by that I mean the stuff that feels really deep in your body and feels really deep in other people's bodies, takes so much time. And there's no actual way to know how much time that takes. And so for me, when you're asking how do you enter, I think I've always written this way, but I especially have been writing this way. You know, I've been joking that nobody, when I read that poem, everyone is super moved by it, but nobody wants to publish it now because it's not part of the news cycle in this moment, right? It's years and years ago. And we live in such a time that is in many ways antithetical to poetry, because poetry is about, you are a witness, you're taking things in, but then you're sitting with them, you're digesting them. That can take anywhere from weeks to years. I mean, that particular poem, I actually found an old draft. My daughter is now 9. I started writing that poem when she was an infant, and I was walking around the park with her strapped to my body, you know. And I had written a version of it that I submitted somewhere, and it had all these weird pieces that were like these interior monologues about, oh my gosh, if I had to be on a boat with my daughter, on my body, and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of that was me. I put up the picture of the little boy. I had it above my desk. And that image was, every time I looked at it, I cried. I just could not. I think maybe, but there's a part of me that just thinks maybe that's part of it, is letting yourself, whatever it is, the way to enter is to, like, what is the thing that kind of cracks you open? And really sitting with that. Like, you don't have to enter in any particular way. Your entry is your heart, you know? So I think what was so difficult for me, you know, and this just shows my age, right? Because I remember writing poetry before the internet. Ah! You just lost half your listeners. They're like, ah, old lady. No, but I mean, seriously, I mean, I'm in my 40s. So, but I'm saying that, like, I remember, and I wrote terrible poetry then, by the way, but I remember sort of having more time to contemplate something that was happening in the world or in my neighborhood. I think we can still do that. I think you just let yourself, because you don't have to, poetry shouldn't be just be about production, you know? It's about the need for artists to be that mirror of the world, you know? And being a mirror means sometimes that you take a long time before you can really see what you need to see. I think it's just patience with self and not allowing social media and other things to dictate your pace. I firmly believe, and I know we're in a time, I mean, here we are having this conversation, you know, and your beautiful program is giving voice to people who maybe wouldn't have a voice. And there is such validity and power to that. But there's also pressure to represent something, just as us living in the world, right? Portland is sort of, is going through such transformation right now, with so many people from other places moving here, and the demographic is changing pretty rapidly in a really good way, but there's pressure. And so I think taking away the pressure and just focusing on who you are as a human in the world and the value that that has as an artist, and giving yourself that space. You know, you don't have to be, I think that's part of it. I was very torn because I was like, who am I to write about the Syrian refugee crisis? I'm not a Syrian, you know, yes, I'm Arab American, yes, 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 but I'm, you know, I don't know what it's like to live in that community. I don't know what it's like to live under Assad. I mean, my gosh, my friends who have actually been doing activism work there, like, they have death threats all the time to themselves and their families. Like, who am I to about that as I sit in my comfortable Portland home, you know, not worrying about someone knocking on my door. But I can't. It's the when you can't look away. I was so paralyzed, I think, by what happened with Trump because my family became very divided over it. And my mom was dead. And I remember being a kid and watching her scream at Trump on the news in New York when he was a real estate mogul for, you know, he did all this illegal stuff, which I never understood when it didn't come up in his campaign, but where he would like hire people to threaten people who were in rent controlled buildings, like elderly people and stuff like that, to scare them to leave the building so he could buy the building and redo it. I mean, stuff like that where, and I remember my sweet mother like screaming at the TV and being like, arrest him. And this was, you know, we're talking about the 80s here. So it's stuff like that where that sort of, those sorts of, I wanted to write about that, but it was so right in my face, I couldn't process it. Maybe I'll write about it 10 years from now, too.
Oh, hopefully by then he will no longer be generating news cycles. But I think that's a really important point, though, about the pressure of time and how, you know, the current media culture is so, you know, you have to be right on it. And the importance of, like you said, sitting with something and kind of digesting it in order to really draw out a response, a valid response. And I know that a lot of us during the pandemic, maybe we're kind of motivated to respond. I know I wrote a lot, especially early in the pandemic, and it felt like I was writing to keep myself alive. It wasn't the best work.
You can forgive yourself for that. I just say, this is where I just say full forgiveness for all things right now. You know, like, I mean, I read you the one poem I wrote. That was it. That was my one. I couldn't do it. I was, I was just trying to keep my family sane. And that was my big thing, and support our community as much as possible. But yeah, there's not a lot of, I don't think there's, I do struggle with it because I realize I don't participate in social media very much, especially not to the, but I've been forgiving myself more. The pandemic has helped me forgive in that the thing that I value is the same as a human is the same thing as I value as an artist, in that I want that intense connection. Mm-hmm. Authentic. I don't like small talk. I'm terrible at it. And it's good to just acknowledge that I don't like small talk and poems either. Like, I want you to get in there and rip my heart out. Like, I just don't, if that's not happening, I mean, I can laugh. It's great. But yeah, that's the stuff that matters to me. That's what moves me.
So I want to kind of switch gears for the last few minutes here. And talk about jazz. Your poetry features a lot of jazz references, not so much the ones that you read today, but some of the other work of yours that I've seen. And it's apparently featuring a lot in your current project. And I think the last poem you read, there was a very jazz-like structure to it with the repetition and the variation. Can you talk about kind of how jazz has been an influence on you, how you've been exposed to it? How's that come about in your life?
You know, my parents, I had old parents. I'm kind of an old parent. It's kind of funny that way. My parents were older. My dad's in his 80s now, and I was the youngest of four, and my parents grew up in an era they used to win dancing competitions in Harlem. How cute is that, right? But my father always took me to, I mean, my goodness, you know, I'm gonna do jazz head things, but my father, like, this had Stan Getz played his prom in New York City. Like, could you bust? But he was a huge John Coltrane fan, and I love Alice Coltrane. Like, oh my gosh, I mean, seriously, I don't know why there's a church to John Coltrane, because I want the church to Alice Coltrane. I adore her so much. Her work, just the way she is in the world, really influences a lot of the stuff I write. And I think, so my parents took me to hear a lot of music as a kid. This was a time in New York where you know, almost everything was free. That makes New Yorkers laugh now. I'm like, no, it was all free. Like, I used to cut class and go to the Metropolitan, and like, there was no fee. So I think all those sorts of things, I can really credit my parents, because they were both, that was their era. They loved jazz. And so it was always playing in my house, along with classical music. And then later on, I played piano very young, and I played mostly, you know, growing up in New York, you know, it's like it's sort of regimented in some ways. When I was a kid, you know, it's like, oh, you do classical and this is how you do it. But when I met my husband, John, he's such, so free of thought as a musician. He's a jazz musician, but he's played with punk rock bands, and he's played classical, and he's, you know, he's done everything. And I think he lives his life by a jazz aesthetic, in that he sees everything as a chance for play and improvisation. And he's more than happy to play with a guy playing bluegrass as much as the blues. You know, he doesn't see that delineation. In fact, he was playing, I don't know, he loves Ethiopian jazz. He was playing Ethiopian jazz this morning as he was making breakfast. So I think those early sonic things as a child, combined with living in a house with a jazz musician. Oh, and by the way, I just had to do a shout out. So last night he had a bunch of friends over, this gorgeous bassist, Xiaowei Wu, who I just adore. He's a local bassist. And then Mike Gamble, this guitarist, they were all playing in the garage. Oh, Teal, it was like the most beautiful thing in the world, just to hear them. Like, it has been 2 years since we've had people over, you know? I mean, and just to hear them all playing, and people in the neighborhood were texting me and going, more, more. But I think that sort of sonic stuff, I like work that has that rhythm and has that play in it. And I think sound is such an important part of poetry, and I often, when I don't hear it in a poem, some kind of play, internal rhyme, something, I miss it, you know. My duo with my husband is a real chance for me to just be a wild girl, you know, just like, I do a lot of howling and singing, and I play a bunch of different frame drums that I have. It's good. I highly recommend everyone should write poetry to Alice Coltrane. Or the other person I think is really amazing is Julius Hemphill. Like, I'm obsessed. Like, I've been listening to a lot of Julius Hemphill. He's definitely out there and fun. But yeah, my daughter was pretty much raised on Sun Ra. My husband was in his Sun Ra phase. There was a lot of Sun Ra happening when she was an infant. It was like, you know, she could hardly like see. You know, she's looking at the light, and then Sun Ra's blaring. Who knows what will happen to that child?
All right, you've been listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month was Claudia Salibi Savage. Claudia, it was so great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Teal. Thank you.
Portland.
KBOO's end of the year drive is happening right now, and we invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Contribute now.